Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, June 10th. This morning, we meet the new head of the Honolulu Zoo. HPR got a chance to connect on his first day on the job. In this political season, we take a closer look at the race for Maui mayor. Should Mayor Richard Bisson be worried? And it used to be that you'd hear lots of jokes about how lawyers were a dime a dozen. Not so much anymore. And we hear the call of the Hawaiian woodpecker on this week's Manu Minute. We also learn from an educator trying to share the idea of a Voyager state of mind to young people across the Pacific and around the world. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. New leadership at the Honolulu Zoo. The city bid aloha to Linda Santos, who retired late last year. She served as director for 7 years, and she started her nearly four-decade-long career at the zoo as a caretaker. John Barry is stepping into her shoes. He served as former director of the Smithsonian National Zoo. Barry has held senior-level positions in conservation and government. And did you know he has a mountain in Antarctica named after him? HPR's Kevin Allen caught up with Barry on his first day at work yesterday. We wanted to know, why Hawaii?
First, my partner of 30 years is a local boy, my husband, Curtis Yee. And he went to, Lincoln, Robert Louis Stevenson, and Roosevelt. So, you know, he goes way back. And we've been together 30 years, and he followed me around everywhere, and it got to be time for thinking about, well, maybe we're going to be near retirement, but let's go home. And so we did, and this is home. His mom is still alive. She's going to turn 100 this Christmas Eve.
Wow, congratulations.
And, you know, I've had two passions, Kevin, in my life. Wildlife conservation has always been one, and in fact, I was inspired to be involved with it by my visits as a young kid to the National Zoo. So I've sort of always, that's been one of my passions, and oftentimes in the nonprofit world, I'd work in the wildlife space. And then I've also had a passion for civil rights, and not only for the LGBTQ community, but for Native Hawaiians. I worked during the Clinton administration on that issue, and I was very proud to, and look forward to continuing to help as much as I can with the disabled community. I was legislative director to Steny Hoyer, who led the fight to get the Americans with Disabilities Act over the finish line, and was really honored to help play a role there. And I've been involved with civil rights for veterans and to make sure that we honor their service. And so, you know, those have been my passion of things that I've been most happy doing have been around those two issues. And when I heard from a friend that, well, you know, they're hiring for the director of the Honolulu Zoo, and I thought, well, this could be, you know, it's great when your passion and your job come together. And I thought, oh, wow, I am putting retirement off.
And yeah, you know, you're coming into it with such fresh eyes, I think. And that's so important, you know, especially for an establishment that's been around for so long. Do you see things that you'd like maybe changed or improved on, or, you know, I guess kind of what's your first reaction?
Look, I think the staff has such great energy. Part of it is just as the leader to try to help communicate that energy to the public of how much people care about wildlife here. And that's very important. I when I met with the staff this morning, I said, look, we have three key missions. You know, first and foremost is the safety of the animals, our staff and the public, and their health and their happiness. So, you know, we want them to not just come here and see great animals as ambassadors. We want them to come and know that, you know, this is a place they can come to be inspired and filled with awe. And you can't get that online. there's a lot of things online can give you, but looking into the eye of a tiger or an elephant or a giraffe, or having a giraffe take a carrot out of your hand, are life-changing experiences for our keiki. And it was for me. I'm still involved with it here. I'm 67. So, you know, it's amazing that it's incredible to be able to see that again. So inspiring awe, I told our team, you know, we've got to do a better job of creating a whole new generation of conservation lovers. And shame on us if we fail. So, you know, I think that can be done. And it's done by teamwork and curiosity and aloha. And if we do those, then the rest will follow. And then finally, and something the public may not be really aware of, Kevin, is the zoo has been phenomenally involved in conservation of endangered species. And if we were just, you know, a menagerie or a collection, we should close our doors. We are here because we can learn about wildlife and we can hopefully contribute back to wildlife and species in the wild. And so already Honolulu Zoo has been a leader in conserving the Hawaii snail, the Hawaiian hawk. We are in trying to figure out how we can best partner to help the alala with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and a number of honeycreeper species at higher elevations because of climate change. Mosquitoes are going higher. So we've been involved and we have one of the largest breeding populations of a couple of honeycreeper species that are, if you will, an insurance population, God forbid, if there's a collapse in the wild. The staff and I are ready to do a lot more in that space. And so we're going to be working with partners like NOAA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're going to reach out to all the nonprofits in this space, like the Nature Conservancy and others. But, you know, there's a million people working on this. And I think the Honolulu Zoo can be a great place to convene them and to come up with ideas for how do we do it better? How do we do more? And how do we help? Because, you know, right now going on Kauai are early indications of a major avian collapse going on at the higher elevations. And the public's not aware of this yet, and it's too early to totally pull the fire alarm, but enough warning signals that this is going to be serious. And so we're talking with Department of Natural Lands and Resources and others and figuring out, well, what can we best do to help? And sometimes, like, you know, when there was a collapse amongst amphibians in Central America, at the time I was at the Smithsonian Zoo, we just went down and into the wild and sent scientists and they collected as many animals. And thank God we did, because those are the only remnants of that entire species. And we're talking, you know, millions of years of evolution now come down to an arc of a couple of trailers where we literally have, you know, the National Zoo has, you know, these frogs still alive. And hoping that when we find the right cure for chytrid, that they can be put back into the wild. But at least if we didn't have them, there'd be no hope. And so we're facing that literally on the island of Kauai now. Some of those higher mountain ranges are now getting those mosquito invasions and carrying avian malaria and other things that we're all praying for better, but let's be ready for the worst.
You do have such a history working in conservation, and I don't think maybe a lot of people really understand, I guess, that the zoo also plays a role in this conservation. And I really love that you're bringing up that point of, yeah, having these just in case, you know, populations. That seems like something that I wish more people knew about, because I think people see zoos sometimes and they think, oh, they're just an attraction, right? But there's so much more than that.
Yeah, no, and I'm a believer. I was raised in the Catholic tradition, and St. Francis of Assisi is my great patron I respect. And he had a great line when someone asked him, do animals have souls? And his answer was, of course they have souls. And they said, well, how do you know? And he says, well, everything God touches is sacred. And God has clearly touched all living things. And therefore, all living things are sacred. And, you know, so when I see these animals, my commitment to them is we're here to make sure they get the best and highest quality treatment, but also aloha and love and respect.
What is it about the Honolulu Zoo that, from your perspective, you just find so unique and so special and maybe kind of one of a kind in the world?
I think the two most important are nobody else is at the foot of Diamond Head. You know, nobody else. You can walk across the street to the Pacific Ocean. Nobody else has fairy terns. They're not captive. They're nesting in the zoo. They're nesting adjacent to the zoo. The gardens here are so beautiful. My dream, Kevin, is I hope that we're going to be able to actually, it takes a lot of work, but to become a formal botanical garden in addition to a zoological park. And we're well on our way because I'll tell you, the staff here has done a phenomenal job with the gardens. If you haven't been recently, it's worth coming back just to see how the great job they have done with the gardens. But I can't wait to work with like the Garden Society and others to help us to figure out, well, you know, I know it's a lot of work to become a formal botanical garden. So I want us to, you know, enter that carefully, that space, but to make sure we can do it. But I think we can. And it's that combination, the beautiful combination of the surrounding environment along with the majesty of the plant and wildlife that you have when you come within these bounds. And so I think what my dream would be, Kevin, is to make the Honolulu Zoo such a magical place that you don't just come once, you come 100 times, because you'll find it a place that refreshes your soul and refreshes your heart and reminds you what it is to be human again. If I can tick that box when I know I've ticked it, will be the time to pass the torch to my successor.
I know it's your first day and you just started, but how would you want your time as director to be remembered? I mean, really, what kind of mark are you leaving? This is the John Barry mark on the Honolulu Zoo.
Well, everything that I want to do is already underway, Kevin. If anything, I just want to take it to a whole nother level, sort of an exponential increase. There's some improvements like in every old institution. You know, it's hard to keep up. It's hard to keep the capital things. Just today, pumps broke. You know, so it's like we're trying to fix that. You know, it just happens. And so it's exciting. I think we can be a convening body for. There's a just an incredible amount of important conservation efforts going on all around all the islands, and most of them operating just out of love and on a dime and a nickel. And we're, like I mentioned, we're already doing a lot of things in wildlife, but because wildlife is facing so many challenges, no one anticipated this avian malaria thing would get as high as fast as it did. So it's happening. And how we respond as a human species is going to determine the quality of life for thousands of species going forward. And shame on us if we can't all roll up our sleeves and get involved. And I encourage people, please volunteer, get involved. We will take your energy and do great things.
All right. Here's your hardest question of the day. Who's your favorite animal and why?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I love them all, Kevin. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, a parent. But I've always loved giraffes. They are just so majestic. And I'll tell you, you can lose yourself in an eye of a giraffe. When a giraffe comes up close to you and looks at you and gives you a look over, you realize you're not the center of the universe. And you realize that, boy, they're just such a majesty and a depth there and a beauty that still inspires awe in me every time I get close to one.
Revealing answer. That was the new director of the Honolulu Zoo, John Barry. He spoke with HBR's Kevin Allen about his plans for the zoo, which can trace its roots back to 1876.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
so much shipping has been disrupted by the shutdown of the Strait of Hormuz. The head of UNICEF for Sudan told me, it's difficult to get stuff trucked to places that are stricken by famine because not only is the price of diesel so expensive, but they're worried they're going to get stuck there.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from the 27th Holly Eva Arts Festival at Holly Eva Beach Park, celebrating over 120 artists with family activities, music, and food. 10 to 5 this Saturday and Sunday, hollyevaartfestival.org.
The race for Maui mayor is drawing a number of challengers for incumbent Richard Bisson. And joining us this morning is Colleen Oweche with the Hawaii Journalism Initiative. Maui Now just published a story that she wrote about a couple of recent polls with some surprising results. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes. So tell us about these polls and what they show.
Yeah. So there's a couple polls that were done by a couple of different firms. And they talked to over 400 voters in Maui County for both of these polls, and they found that Yukile Sugimura, who's the vice chair of the Maui County Council and is challenging incumbent Mayor Richard Bisson for the mayor's office, she has a lead over him of at least 10 percentage points in each of these polls, which I talked to a local political analyst, Colin Moore, and he said that's a pretty sizable lead and pretty surprising at this stage of the race. You know, we've got a couple months to go before the primary in August. And so, according to these polls, it sounds like Bisson may have some ground to catch up on. But his camp also says, we did our own polling, and we found that Bisson has a lead over Sugimura. So, regardless of which poll ends up being right in the end, it, you know, we've got a competitive race on our hands.
No kidding, yeah. So it could be neck and neck. And some might think, you know, this is surprising to have a race where you've attracted so many challengers.
Definitely. It's not surprising that we have so many people, because often the Maui County Mayor's race does get a lot of candidates in the primary, but it is surprising that the incumbent, according to some of these polls, is not leading. Because, you know, typically the incumbent has the advantage, right? You know, they've been in office for the past how many years, and they've had a chance to have people get to know them, see what they can accomplish, but it can backfire on you, right, if you do things that people don't always agree with. And so the advantage that Bisson has in this race of, you know, being the incumbent, being well-known, is kind of offset by the fact that Yukile Sugimura is also very well-known in the community. You know, she's been a council member since 2016 and has also been involved in a lot of different events and, you know, different political campaigns also here on Maui. And so, you know, people know who she is. And so it's interesting because I think it's kind of a similar dynamic to 2022 when Bisson ran against Victor Reno. And he actually beat Victor Reno in the primary because he also came with his own longtime legacy of service on Maui. People knew who he was, and now he's up against a similar challenge with Sugimura.
Yeah, I mean, as a former judge, yes, he, you know, certainly had a standing in the community. But, you know, I guess when you think back of, you know, the challenges that Maui has been dealt, right, with the wildfires, and, you know, it just was really just an unprecedented event to have happened. And, you know, the county has been really working to help heal the community.
Definitely. And that's always going to be part of the conversation, right, is, you know, the fire happened in 2023, very early in, you know, Bisson's first term. And it's been a huge defining part of his term. And, you know, I talked to him and he said, you know, the way that people feel about how the recovery is going is probably going to depend on where they are at in the recovery, right? You know, you have people who've rebuilt their homes. They feel more optimistic about how the county's doing, and others who haven't rebuilt their homes, or, you know, businesses who haven't returned. That's a big issue in Lahaina, maybe more, you know, disillusioned with the way things are going. But some people I've talked to have said, we think he deserves another chance. He got dealt a bad hand. And others are saying, no, we want some change. So, you know, the fire is a big factor in Bill 9 as well. That was proposed to, you know, phase out vacation rentals in certain districts to hopefully increase housing after the fire. And so Bill 9 and the fire have been two really big issues that have definitely factored into some of the candidates' decisions to run.
Yes, and you know, affordable housing is just, you know, top of mind for so many people on so many islands, but you know, so is the cost of living. And Maui, to me anyway, has always seemed pretty expensive.
Yeah, Maui is very expensive, unfortunately. And so the cost of living, affordability, you know, housing, those are the biggest issues. You know, the fire, that's a huge issue as well. And it's made worse by the fact that we didn't have enough housing to begin with. And so when you talk to people, you see these polls, affordability and housing are consistently the issues that people are raising. And so they're frustrated with that. And for some people, they see, you know, the housing that has been, you know, built over the last, you know, few years. You know, Bissin has pointed to the housing that his administration has been able to support. And Yuki Lei Sugimura has also pointed to the housing, you know, that she's voted to support as well. But for people, I think it's not enough, you know. And to be fair, I don't think anybody, you know, one single administration or, you know, council can solve this housing crisis. It's decades in the making, and it's going to take a long time for us to solve it, unfortunately.
Yeah, so I don't know what you're seeing, though, boots on the ground, as far as, you know, how these two leading candidates and are going to duke it out.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting for sure. They're both very well-known, very popular candidates. And what's interesting, too, is they're also running pretty clean campaigns where they're avoiding attacking each other personally. You know, they're pointing more to their own records. Bissin said that he talked to, you know, Yuki Lei Sugimura, you know, before the race and said, hey, let's just like keep this clean. Let's not make personal attacks. Let's focus on policy. And that's what they've been doing. And so it remains to be seen, you know, which message is going to win over voters more. And as we were talking about, if people have frustrations with affordability and housing, that may be something that's driving them to push for a change candidate, regardless of who it is.
Okay. And, you know, your article does cover the other candidates in the field.
Definitely. Yeah. These other candidates, the way that they can factor into the race, Colin Moore, the political analyst, was talking about how some of them may take votes away, you know, from it depends who they take votes away from, Bissin or Sugimura. So we'll see what happens in the primary.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Colleen.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Colleen Oweche. To read her story, head to MauiNow.com.
Support for HPR comes from Revolusun in Hawaii since 2009, providing energy solutions for homeowners. Learn more about options for backup power when a weather event happens at revolusun.com.
Here's one way to get more involved with Hawaii Public Radio. Apply to join our community advisory board. Your feedback as a volunteer advisor helps shape programs and events. Listeners from all islands are encouraged to apply. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/CAB. Deadline to apply is June 26.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Employers Council's annual Talent Summit, June 26th at the Ala Moana Hotel, bringing together stakeholders to address workforce challenges. Registration at hecouncil.org.
Where have all the lawyers gone? Well, it's a question we never thought we'd ask, but a new task force established by the Hawaii Supreme Court aims to address worrying trends in legal representation here in Hawaii. The task force convened for the first time last month, and its leaders say the profession is experiencing brain drain, an aging workforce, and key gaps in practice areas. Attorneys that focus on workers' compensation number in the single digits. Think about that, the single digits. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with the co-chairs of the task force about shifting the tide away from the silver tsunami. Mark M. Murakami is an attorney at the law firm Damon Key, and he's the past president of the Hawaii State Bar Association. Justice Todd Evans serves on the Hawaii Supreme Court. Justice Evans starts us off.
Yeah, you know, Hawaii does have a shortage of lawyers, and it's not everywhere. It's not in any, every practice, but in some places and in some areas, there are real problems. There's real shortages as far as distribution of lawyers in our state. There's shortages of some practice areas. For example, rural and neighbor islands have a decreased amount of lawyers, and it's been flatlining really over the years. Quietly but thinly, lawyers have been retiring, and admissions to new bar admissions has not outpaced the people who have been retiring. And that's presented problems. You know, neighbor islands are shortage, and in general practice areas. For example, in our criminal defense areas, in our public prosecution areas, in immigration law, in civil legal aid law, in elder law, workers' compensation law, there is a noticeable decline in lawyers. And that compromises access to justice to our courthouses, because access to a lawyer is not a luxury. Rights are enforced. Rights are not real unless a lawyer is there beside someone when they enter the courthouse. You know, we talk about open courthouses, but those open courthouses really don't mean as much unless a lawyer is there to walk beside someone as they enter our courthouses.
Is what you're saying essentially, as these practice areas have fewer and fewer lawyers, or these areas, if we're thinking about the neighbor islands, individuals might have claims that are worthy of legal representation, but there just aren't enough lawyers for them?
Absolutely. There's been an explosion of self-represented litigants, and you know, they do as best as they can, but nothing beats having, you know, a true practitioner there to represent one's legal positions. And we have really seen, and it's not just the neighbor islands, it's really in our Honolulu courts as well, that our shortage of lawyers, which is really flatlined, we're not admitting as many lawyers as we did just 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I graduated from law school about 35 years ago. Mark, similarly, long were, you know, seasoned lawyers. But back then, there was a lot more lawyers coming into Hawaii and being barred in Hawaii. And there's just been a noticeable decrease, a significant decrease, and the numbers bear that out.
Mark, talk a little bit more about that. You were president of the Hawaii State Bar Association, and your organization found that 43% of its members were over the age of 60, nearly half over the age of 60. What does that mean for the aging workforce?
You know, and some of it is, to become an attorney, there's a long lead training path. And so you have to go to undergrad. There's a three-year law school. A good chunk of folks go to the marketplace, or school teachers decide they really want to be a lawyer and then come in. And so usually you don't start your legal career until your early 30s. And you usually work into your 60s or 70s. You probably can work a little longer. But you really don't hit the sweet spot in terms of your professional career where you have enough experience to be by yourself in a courtroom handling a major dispute, where you can lead a transactional team to do the due diligence for an investor to buy a hotel or something. Until your late 40s, early 50s, that's kind of your sweet spot professionally. And so because of that, I think we as a profession have to look backwards and make sure that the younger generation has enough numbers to flow through the system to cover all the legal needs that Hawaii has. If you just look at the numbers of judges, you know, we probably have about 65, 70 judges, with most of them having clerks. And so there's a huge chunk of folks that are committed for us to have in our society a civil and criminal justice system, that those are fixed, that you have to have. And so the standard entry point for a judge is probably, you know, 50, and they can only work till 70 because there's a constitutional mandatory retirement date. And so you only have a narrow window for a judge. Now you kind of magnify that, and you need to have a lot of lawyers. I mean, it's, when I was preparing today, it's a little trite because, you know, Shakespeare talked about in Merchant of Venice, right, get rid of all the lawyers as a good thing for society. However, if you're facing a DUI charge, if you're facing a felony charge, you better darn well have a, you know, a competent, qualified private defense attorney or public defender for you to navigate that huge event in your life. A divorce attorney. A lot of folks get divorced, and you need to have both spouses represented in order to make a very painful exposure to the legal system as competent and qualified and straightforward as possible. And so those require human beings, and those require licensed, qualified attorneys, and we just aren't generating enough of them.
You bring up this issue of a pipeline, that it's not just attorneys in practice areas, that we're talking about something as significant as judges in our courts. And I think all of us probably remember Chief Justice Mark Rechtenwald stepping down and kind of the question of who was going to succeed and there not being enough applicants. And am I connecting dots that shouldn't be connected, or are those two or more things potentially related?
I do think that the numbers of judicial applicants, and I don't want to just focus on the Chief Justice because we see it at all levels of judges, that the numbers of judicial applicants are down. And so I do think that's indicative of a problem that our task force is looking at, in terms of we don't have enough Gen X attorneys in their 50s. And that is a problem with our government legal offices. That's a problem with the private firms on Bishop Street. And that's a problem because we're not going to see enough judicial applicants. And there's a lot of reasons why that is. Some of it's just the demographics. And so a lot of issues there. The numbers of applicants for the Chief Justice was a huge problem. And we've got now a new Chief Justice. But I think that our problem is more broad because we're seeing the numbers of judicial applicants, and especially neighbor islands, are going to have a lot of problems because there just aren't enough attorneys there who are going to be, you know, constitutionally, you have to be 10 years licensed in order to apply for our circuit court judges and above. And so finding a litigator with 10 years below the age of 50 so they can get 10 years to get the state retirement benefits, that's a small pool of folks.
Justice Edens, anything you'd add on this topic?
You know, and Chief Justice Rechtenwald, I think, spoke a little bit about this, is the mandatory retirement age. The mandatory retirement age in Hawaii, and it's in the Constitution, and it goes back, you know, decades and decades, is age 70. And I think that's a relic of the past. And that, I believe, is one reason why applicants are down, because somebody who's sort of hitting their sweet spot and they're maybe their mid-50s or early 60s is disinclined to join the bench if they're not going to necessarily be there for a large part of the end of their careers. So I think that is one issue. Another is that we do have fine judges in our states that have had to retire at age 70. For example, one of our best judges in the state for many, many years, a Maui judge, Peter Cahill, is now going to have to retire very soon. And we've lost judges left and right because of that. I think it's an impediment to people looking to a judicial path to have an artificial age. That being said, I think, you know, one other reason as to the shortages of judges are just sort of what Mark was touching upon, is that, you know, younger people coming in have different interests and different ideas. And then, you know, when they are hitting their sweet spot, they're making a lot more money. Now, granted, there was a push, and we're much, judiciary is very grateful to the governor and the legislature for bumping up the pay for judges. So I think that's helped. But it's just one of these issues, like the task force is addressing writ large with lawyers, that it's a difficult area to really come to solutions on. Now, our task force is mainly focused on the lawyer shortage and the pipeline, and increasing that pipeline for new lawyers. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. And Mark and I have been thinking along the lines of, you know, not just college students and those who are actually progressing to law school, but digging into, you know, high school students and getting them very interested in the law. And there's great civic education programs that the judiciary is implementing. And, you know, we have mock trial in the high schools, which is just a highly successful program over the years run by the Hawaii State Bar Association's Young Lawyers Division. And we see, you know, I judge it every year, and I just see the enthusiasm and the energy of our high school students. And it's really, really, you know, refreshing and heartening to see all that. And then years later, I run into people at the law school and say, yeah, you were the judge of my mock trial. So there's those types of things we can do to address the shortage. And Our task force, which is just a bunch of outstanding lawyers, judges, broad cross-section of our state's brilliant judicial minds and legal minds, is going to be looking at everything. Everything's on the table to try to just see what we can do about addressing the issue, because, you know, the numbers have flatlined, but our population has increased, obviously, over the years. And certainly, you know, legal issues and legal needs have also steadily increased. So we have an 18-month window to look at these issues, and everything is really on the table.
Thank you both so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was attorney Mark M. Murakami and Hawaii Supreme Court Justice Todd Eddins. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about the legal task force formed to address a growing shortage of lawyers here in Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
Most Americans are frustrated with the news.
To me, Fox News just not, they don't tell the whole story.
I'm not particularly interested in MSNBC.
And that's where I'd get irritated and not want to listen to it.
But what if we're wrong about what's really wrong with journalism? The cracked foundation of the Fourth Estate on the next Reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
We'd like to share feedback that you've sent us about recent shows and segments. Following our interview with Governor Josh Green last week, we heard from Dieter Runge, who writes, "This is the second time our governor is trying to convince us that a multi-billion-dollar LNG power plant is a good thing for us. He was equally unconvincing as during the first time I heard him talk about it on The Conversation. What became clear is that the current regime in D.C. is basically forcing it on us, and we are happy to take the cash." And after our segment featuring Jonathan Easer, who for decades held the record for the youngest swimmer to cross the Ka'iwi Channel, we heard from Stephen Minalia. He writes, "The Hawaiian Channel Swimming Association, formed back in 1984, has ratified 138 swim crossings of the Ka'iwi Channel to date. The number of successful swimmers doubled in just the last 7 years." And in response to our spotlight of the Wailua girls making waves as the first girls' championship in surfing, Lauren Rowland writes, "So proud and stoked to have these girls as role models for the younger Wailua surfer girls. Congrats, team." Have a question or comment about a recent segment? Write to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also leave us a voicemail on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to Hawaii's version of the woodpecker.
Akeapola owl are large, bright yellow honeycreepers that act like woodpeckers. They use their strong lower bill to peck holes in branches of trees. Then they use their long, curved upper bill to pry out the tasty insect larvae. There are less than 2,000 of these birds left, mainly because of habitat loss and mosquito-transmitted avian malaria. And nowadays, their song can only be heard in high-elevation koa forests on the Big Island, where it's too cold for mosquitoes. In addition to controlling mosquitoes, planting koa forests would be a great way to increase populations of this very rare and important species. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, James Campbell, Ko'olau Mountains, and Pearl Harbor. More at friendsofoahunwr.org.
Finding our way. It's a concept that early explorers and our native navigators of the Pacific embraced out of need. And as our current day voyagers relearn lessons of wayfinding, one educator thought the metaphor was fitting to apply to our mental health and finding our way. Matt Limtiako has roots both in Guam and Hawaii. He currently lives on the East Coast, but returns to what he knew growing up and learning from elders. He's developed a textbook, Voyager State of Mind, that he hopes will help communities that he holds dear to his heart.
When I first started teaching, I was invited on board a sailing vessel with my uncle Jack Silas, and he took us out, and I just saw how my whole family was engaged in all the different roles in the sailing vessel, and we all pitched in and helped out, and I decided this is a great metaphor for our classroom, and what if we took this metaphor of sailing into the classroom, and I first started this idea of sailing and being on a crew and going on a voyage with my fourth graders. And I said, all of you have special roles on our sailboat. And I called it Starwind. This was way back. And as I went on in my career, you know, I was working with the DOE, Hawaii State DOE, for some time. And then I was privileged to work with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And it was with the Office of Papahanaumokuakea, Marine National Monument. And it all started off with this gift that my students gave to Auntie Laura Thompson. And she came and received this huge map that we had made of the main eight Hawaiian Islands and Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. And they explained all these different, you know, clay islands that they had built. So it was a 3D map. And when she received it, the folks at NOAA had come as well and had seen the work we were doing with the kids. And so they invited me to work with Navigating Change. And that, of course, introduced me to the folks at Polynesian Voyaging Society. And then this idea of being a crew member on board, it kind of went from Starwind to like, hey, this is, we're icon of voyaging canoe. This is from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. This is like a voyage. And so we had different crew members on board our sort of classroom va'a. Each person had a very important role, critical to us getting from one place to the next. And I was really feeling like this was really working well for our students, because they had an opportunity to get to know each other. They had an opportunity to set goals, and each person really felt valuable on this voyage. From there, my wife and I moved to Egypt, and we were living in Cairo for some time. And the metaphor really worked there well too, as you wouldn't think it because it's in the middle of the desert, but there's the Nile there.
Navigating up the Nile.
That's right. And they have these amazing canoes there called feluccas. They're these sailing vessels that are just on another level. So the idea of sailing really translated to the students there as well. And my students, they picked out values and they picked out protocols for our classroom. And again, we were sailing across time with our students there. Our students there in Cairo also put together their own values, and they did that with the work of the imam at our school. And so they picked out eight voyaging values that translated well to their culture there. And later down the road, I had found out I had given a presentation over in Palau on a video we had produced that spoke to voyaging values. And I met this woman that said, boy, you should be working with Rob Limtiako. Do you know Rob Limtiako? Of course, my name is Limtiako. And I was like, I don't think I've ever heard of him. Well, he carves canoes. He's on Guam. He was a part of this huge renaissance of canoe building on Guam. And I'm like, how do I not know this person? So I find out, she hooks me up with him, and I start talking to this person I'd never known, and we track our lineage. And so we find out, gosh, we're kind of connected here. Maybe we should be thinking about doing some things. And lo and behold, at the very same time, University of Guam was hiring for a position at the Elementary Ed School of Education. And they needed someone to fill a position there as a professor. And so I applied, and I thought, oh, no chance I'm going to get that. But they hired me on, and immediately got together with my Uncle Rob, and I started saying, hey, what if we did something really special where we created an idea about voyaging values, about getting to know each other as a crew, getting, you know, create goals and waypoints and think about how we drive our classroom forward. And of course, he had no idea what I was talking. He was like, I don't know if I get this, but let's just keep talking. And so we talked for probably about a year and a half before we finally started settling on an idea. And Dr. Shinhua Lee at the School of Counseling was really instrumental in that, because she had really been interested in thinking about how students could be more connected with their culture, be more connected with their history and their contemporary life, but translate that to counseling. And so I said, what if we wove these two ideas together? What if we thought about bringing in proven counseling strategies and stories that are applicable to the canoe? And so that's when me and Uncle Rob and Dr. Shinhua Lee got together. And then we hooked up with Jess Merrill, who's an amazing illustrator and graphic designer. And we just started perusing this idea, and we charted a course across a typical school year and thought about, okay, what would students experience?
Right, a lesson plan, right?
A sail plan for a school year. And we thought about, what are the experiences that students might have? And we vetted this with a group of teachers we had that worked with us at Maria Ulloa Elementary. They were our pilot school. And we had all of these lessons charted out across the school year that allowed students to get to know each other, establish their own roles and rules, set goals, and become really empathetic with each other. So it's basically a social emotional support book that allowed students to really gel.
Well, I love the title.
Voyager State of Mind.
Yes.
Thank you. We really wanted students to think about their own lives as a voyage. We really wanted students to think about their own experience in a classroom, because that is your crew for a whole year. And we designed it in a way also, I'm glad you bring that up, because one of my own students at UOG, her name is Caitlin Bartonico. She's a fantastic student of mine. And she was also one of our test pilots at Maria Ulloa Elementary. I remember her saying, I don't know, this is, I feel a little funny about talking about voyaging in my classroom because I'm not a voyager myself. And I said, Caitlin, that's exactly what we want. We want people who feel a connection to this idea, but don't know really where to start, and we want to give you just a little bit of support so that you can think about this as just a way to think about your life. And best case scenario, some of these kids become voyagers themselves because they're inspired by it. Worst case scenario, they get to know each other really well through the process and lesson plans that this book delivers to students. And so she tested it out in the classroom with a lot of success and really appreciated it, because she helped to even shape the lessons so that they were really teacher friendly.
Yeah, so you're really charting a course for our mental well-being.
That's right. Yeah, I think we have a scope and sequence for math. We have a scope and sequence for literacy. We have scopes and sequences for even the basics of how to learn your words, from CVC all the way up to genres, book reading. And I think to not have a scope and sequence for your classroom about social emotional support and tie that to what's important to us, our history and contemporary life, is missing an opportunity. And there were these stories that came out of these conversations with Uncle Rob. They were just so amazing. You know, I can recall one particular story, this Ray Flores. He's an amazing sailor. He's also a breath-hold diver and a spearfisher. And so we have these pictures of him, you know, diving for huge fish off the coast of Guam and the Marianas. And he's also a fantastic surfer. So we have this picture of him charging this gigantic wave. And, you know, what kid wouldn't see that and go, oh, my gosh, this guy's amazing. But he ties this idea to breath hold, to this idea of how to use your breath to calm down. And we always talk about these things with our students. If they get a little dysregulated, say, well, just use your breath, just use your breath. But what if we tied that to someone that they're already really inspired by? We have all these different stories of folks that are really inspirational to kids. And they see themselves because these are people in their community. And most of all, I think it really pays homage to Uncle Rob Limtiaco and his contribution to the sailing community, and also his mentors, because they're all in there as well.
I think just this whole idea of the renaissance of navigation and just extending it out and helping us all learn how to be better navigators.
Yeah, navigators right? of life. I think even every time I read it myself, you know, it's meant really for a fifth grade audience, but every time I read it, I pick it up, I'm inspired, and I think of a life lesson that I take with me. And so I'm just eternally appreciative of all of the folks, you know, the mentors of Uncle Rob, Rapui, Tawa, the people that took him under their wing and trusted him. And they gave him this gift, right? And then Uncle Rob, he bestowed me with the trust to develop this book and make it come to life. And in doing that, we've been able to gift these stories to kids. It's just this constant flow of gift giving, you know?
Well, I think because you have been to and lived in all these places, knowing that there's a segment of our community here in Hawaii, there's a whole generation of our Micronesian children who are just here in Hawaii and have never been to their home island, whether it's Chuuk or Ponape. And I think this could speak to them in a different way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are definitely places and people that are mentioned in this book that will be really familiar to our students from neighbor islands. I think also it really just breaks those boundaries of all of these values are good human values, you know. So we have values from Pulawat. We have values from the Philippines. We have values from Hawaii mentioned in the book and highlighted. And the idea isn't so much to say by any means by polarizing folks or separating folks or putting people in silos. It's we're all in this together, and we're all sailing on this voyage together. We all have this connection to this amazing, amazing achievement of voyaging. And so I think that not only can we all be proud of it, and especially our students who have a lineage of that, we can all learn something from it, you know. And I'm hoping whether it's folks in Egypt or folks in California or folks in Guam or folks here in Hawaii, everybody could get something out of some of these stories and lessons. And I hope it's, you know, just a little piece of the healing that needs to go on, and not in, just in our schools, but in our community.
That was Matt Limtiaco, author of The Voyager State of Mind. It's a textbook to help our youth navigate the world we live in, because life is a voyage. Look for links to find out more on our website later today. We have to go now. Tomorrow, we have special programming in place for the state holiday. On Friday, a conversation is planning to go on the road. We head down to Honolulu Harbor to take a closer look at the cruise industry. Got a cruise story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website, we're available as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow. Pick up The Conversation.